and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we like to say each week, this conversation includes you. If you'd like to join us, you might want to write down these numbers now so you can jump in whenever you like. 941-3689 is the number from Oahu, 941-3689, and from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. That number also works if you're listening to the live stream from someplace else and would like to join us. You've heard this before. Drug overdoses kill more Americans than car crashes. The ODs can be from prescription painkillers, street drugs, and or alcohol. Late last week, President Obama signed the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovering Act, CARA, as the law is known. It provides for six directions for a national response to addiction: prevention, treatment, recovery support, criminal justice reform, overdose reversal, and law enforcement. The law includes the use of naloxone, an opioid response inhibitor. Among many other CARA provisions are resources for quick identification plus evidence-based treatment of inmates incarcerated for drug use. The new law also authorizes the launch of a nationwide evidence-based heroin and opioid treatment and intervention program consistent with best practices. Although the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act is now law, there still remains the issue of how much money will be appropriated to carry it out. Today, my guests will consider the new law and how it may affect their current work in addiction recovery and how it may affect us here in Hawaii. Making a return visit to the program is First Circuit Court Judge Stephen Alm. He is the principal judge for Hawaii's Opportunity Probation with Enforcement Project, a program he founded in 2004. The HOPE program is now used in 31 states. Alan Johnson also joins us again. He is president and CEO of Hina Mauka, a recovery organization with a 40-year history of providing treatment and addiction recovery support for adults, teens, and families. He's also the chair of the Hawaii Substance Abuse Coalition, a hui of about 25 nonprofit treatment and prevention agencies throughout the state. And Dr. Scott Miskovich is here, too. He's the chairman of the State Narcotic Policy Steering Committee. His group is working toward comprehensive legislative change to address overdose death, addiction, and narcotic diversion in the state. He is a primary care physician in practice in Kaneohe. And, of course, again, you're here, too. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, as we take a look at a new piece of legislation, CARA. Thank you all for being here.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Thank you for inviting us.
This piece of legislation was long time in the making. It took several years of coming back before it actually made it through Congress, and last Friday was signed by the president. As you look at what finally came through this bill, how do you assess the bill as we see it now? Scott, I'll start with you now.
I think everyone that's been in the trenches fighting this is very, very happy with how comprehensive it is. It really is addressing every key aspect of what we've been asking for. You know, when you went down the titles of the different programs, it really does reach out to everything we need. Now, obviously, the details will be, you know, yet to be determined. We have to figure out how we're going to implement this, and especially here in the state, we're excited to see how we can become part of this.
Judge Alm, when you look at the law enforcement part of it, that provision.
Well, I think what's exciting is it really is comprehensive. And one of the nice problems we have now is that we are at the bottom as far as opiate and synthetic opiate deaths in the country. But I think that's what's so important about the statewide working group, is trying to get proactive about it, working with the legislature so we can stay at the bottom of that ranking. We were 50th out of 50th in accidental overdoses. But it's nice to see they do mention methamphetamine as far as for prevention programs, and there is programs for law enforcement, and I think there's – what's exciting is it also deals with where we can get involved in the courts from a drug court standpoint, veterans treatment court standpoint, so we can try to stay ahead of this problem as much as we can.
And also additional training for law enforcement to be able to recognize what this is relative to something else that someone might think it could be.
Right, and training for first responders, whether that's the police officers, whether that's the fire department, whether that's the EMTs.
As you look at that part of it, that first responder part, also the entire idea of criminal justice reform, How do you see that bridge happening? Because it's, you know, it's easy to say criminal justice reform, but as you look at it in the context of this bill, where do you think this goes?
Well, I think we can, when we can actually help people with their problems. When I used to be the United States Attorney, I'd say you can't arrest your way out of a problem, this kind of a problem. But as we develop more effective ways for the courts to deal with it, whether it's with HOPE, whether it's in drug court, veterans treatment court, mental health court, and this does approach this area from all of those angles, I think we can be – we now have tools where we can be effective in helping people to deal with their substance abuse issues. And the courts do have a coercive power that can help people to go to treatment, to see their treatment providers and the like. I can tell you Dr. Miskovich and I, without sharing any confidences, do share a number of people that we both intersect in what we're doing, and I think our work can support each other.
And I would bet that some of those people also intersect with you, Alan Johnson, and Hina Malka.
I do. I do see a lot of them, so we all three work together.
So when you look at this and the idea of creating some sort of standard for best practices, or that everybody's, you know, singing from the same song sheet in terms of how they approach treatment and looking at the evidence-based treatment, the efficacy of that, and not just to have sort of pods of people who are doing things well and others that maybe not so. Is it possible to network these well through the states, given the fact that, you know, maybe this is not so well funded?
Yes, I believe that this is a really great bill. We were hoping for two things. You know, the one is that it would change the attitudes, remove the stigma of treatment, and so that other doctors and state systems and law enforcement and everybody else would now say, okay, treatment is the way to go. I mean, we've known that for 20 years, and most systems have changed, but they still fragment and they don't work together because we still got that stigma out there. So we really were looking for that. And then second is we were looking for it to reform treatment, through payment reform, and that part didn't happen, and that part was in there but then fell short right at the last minute. So there's going to have to be more steps, and the payment reform is needed. Is that we have a multiple chronic illness model with people have a variety of issues, and we treat them only for their substance abuse and don't treat them for their other issues, and so that needs to be changed. And across the nation they're saying, hey, let's really reform treatment, the payment reforms, so that we can do that part, because we would save lots of money. So the saving lots of money doing the treatment didn't really happen. But the landmark for us is that there are a lot of government systems out there that still look at substance abuse as not the best thing, or let's not talk about it. And the federal government, bipartisan effort, said, no, treatment is the way to go. Let's talk about it, whether it's incarceration, whether it's emergency rooms, whether it's primary care. We need to make changes there, and we've got to educate people, and we've got to help them come along.
When we talk about money and all this effort, too, last time that we were all together, we talked about, you know, the relative cost for not treating somebody but having them go in and out of the system, and or that played against what may happen if they're properly treated, even though there may be some recidivism, there may be some who simply drop out of recovery and have to maybe find their way back. Judge Alm, you see a lot of people who come into that position.
Without question. And if I work with Dr. Miskovich with certain patients, Alan Johnson and Hina Malka are one of the biggest players in the criminal justice system as far as treatment. And we try to emphasize the fact that if you can deal with things on the outside, if you can help people go to treatment and not have to pay to have them in jail or prison, it's $51,000 a year now for people in state prison.
Which is more than it was the last time we talked a little bit.
It was $46,000 right. The last time. It's about that's in Hawaii. It's about $29,000 a year in Arizona. We have 1,400 men doing their time there. But all that money goes to a private out-of-state prison. It doesn't do our economy any good. And it separates these inmates from their families, the support structure. They were paying a lot of money to call back, collect. It really is a terrible way. And I think it's an abdication of our role in government. We should be taking care of our own people here. We shouldn't be sending them to another state.
But you all know that a lot of people will hear that and say, that sounds good, but I really don't want that to be down the street from me. I'm really concerned about who might be my neighbors if they're coming out of a program. Like
well,
this.
One thing, we can slightly increase the size of our existing facilities and do a better job on probation and parole and not have to build a new prison. You know, for existing spots, the jail we have now in Kalihi, OCCC, that is going to get moved to somewhere else, maybe on the grounds of Halava. And if you build a new jail the right way, like the Federal Detention Center, you don't need to have nearly as many staff. Part of the reason it's so expensive to run right now is it's hodgepodge layout. You need a lot of staff because the sight lines are bad. The federal detention facility is run in a very efficient way. We can do the same thing with a new jail with cameras and other things. You don't need a big footprint. It can be much more effectively run.
What kind of savings do you see that we would be realizing?
I don't have a dollar figure, but the most expensive part to run a program is staff. And if you can vastly reduce the number of guards you need at a facility, you really can reduce your cost of running it regularly. So I think that's what they were looking at, increase the size of the facilities on the neighbor islands when they're reconstructed. And that's got to be first priority because they're in horrible condition. And then we got to take care of the jail. I really think we can do that and bring the rest of the folks to house them here rather than on the mainland. And we're also leasing, I believe the number is 400 beds from the feds at the federal detention facility for state prisoners right now.
Well, jump in on that is that what we're looking at that this bill is really talking about is saying that for the law enforcement, for public safety aspects, there's a lot of drug addicts in jail that are low risk, not a safety issue. Now, prison should be for those a safety issue. That's where they should go. But for all those drug addicts who are not a safety issue, there is treatment out there. And when you combine what Project Hope is doing with judge oversight and parole and probation and treatment to treat all those folks both before they get in there to go to in, while they're in jail before they go to prison, and then when they come out of prison so that they're low risk, it's not their major criminal issue, they've got a drug issue, and if we treat that, then they're no longer going the system. I think, you know, they talked before when the legislature did their study, they said $160 million could be saved if we design that kind of system. And what this bill is doing is saying, hey, look, at what we're going to do is we're going to fund a prevention attitude where we're going to say Department of Health and Public Safety have to talk to each other, and we have to include Medicaid in that, and or Quest, and we have to find solutions on how to deal with the offender issue, especially these low risk drug addicts, because there's no way that we're not having a good approach to solving this problem.
A couple comments on that is that there are programs across the country in municipalities where they, when they have enough access to care, they don't even go into incarceration. Basically, when there's a low-risk offender, they are basically put right in and given the option of jail or an immediate treatment. And, you know, that's something that has been shown success. The second thing that this bill has, when you do have someone imprisoned, it's talking about medication-assisted treatment prior to a person leaving prison. A lot of times a person gets into prison, has a severe addiction, and they are then cut loose. There's not a lot of attention. Most people don't realize they're 6 to 7 times at risk for a fatal overdose within the first 2 to 4 weeks when discharged from prison, because they go right back to the same habit, right back to the same quantity of drug that they used, and their body is not used to it. So there is a nice legislation here that says we got to do something before we just turn these people out in the street. We've got to help them, and we have to have coordination within this system with like Alan's program and other programs.
If you're just joining us now tonight, we're taking a look at a piece of legislation President Obama signed last Friday, the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act of 2016. It's usually referred to by its acronym CARA, C-A-R-A, and what it would do for the states in general, and in particular, what might be happening here in Hawaii. We want to hear from you. Probably haven't been following this one. It's been a busy couple of weeks, a lot of things taking our attention. But even so, this has been something that those around my table have been working a long time to see happen. Judge Stephen Alm is here, Dr. Scott Miskovich is here, and Alan Johnson from Hina Malka, and you too. Judge Alm.
I wanted to pick up on something that Dr. Miskovich just said, that people may have this mistaken idea that when somebody dies of an overdose, it's because they got a new supply of something that's a lot purer than otherwise, or they took a whole bunch extra. But one of the most common ways for this to happen is somebody doesn't use drugs for a while, so doesn't use the opiates for a while. Their tolerance drops markedly. And if they then pick it up again and use the same dose they used before, it's going to kill them. And we've had to be sensitive to that because when we're judges, we are often the cause of somebody going to the jail. And unfortunately, there's drug use in there, I think less opioids than methamphetamine or marijuana. But if we're the ones causing them not to be using for a while because of misbehavior, then when they get out, they have to be Akamai to the idea that if they pick up the same dose, it's going to kill them. So I talked to them about that in court. The most predominant drug by far in court, illegal drug, is methamphetamine. But for the opioid users, the OxyContin, oxycodone, heroin users, if they go into jail, I do have that conversation with them about when they get out. They have to be – I have to be careful about this. I'm not going to say the next time you violate the law and use, but I say if your tolerance is way down if you're going to do 2 weeks in jail. If you get out and use the same dose you used before, it's going to kill you. But what's really exciting to me is all the coordination and talking about – doing this with people in the criminal justice system, doing this with people in the prevention system, and getting them all working together. We're doing some of that already, but it's great to see federal legislation that says this is important.
I think you must have been looking over my shoulder. I was writing, coordinated effort is so important. But that just seems to be it. I mean, for a lot of people, it's almost a no-brainer that certain parts of this whole equation have been operating in isolation for a very long time, or maybe talking to one or two other parts. But the whole point of this is to be able to create something that is balancing both education and treatment, but in a way that brings it together with some sort of standard of operation. If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. President Obama signed it last Friday. And whereas other things may be taking your attention this week, this is something that you might want to give some thought to. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. With the number of people that we know are addicted to substances of various different types, and the fact that you've got cross addictions too, this is nothing that's going to simply be, here's the solution to it. But it's a very good step in a direction that all of you have been trying to move us in for a very long time. To be able to coordinate those efforts better here, just let's take Hawaii, for example. What do you think has to happen as a first step under this act? And given the fact that we don't even yet know how much money is going to be put behind this, is there anything that you see happening immediately? And I'm watching heads shake a little bit.
I want to highlight the another document that probably should be talked about in parallel to this, and that's called the Compact to Fight Opioid Addiction. And Governor Ige was one of the signatories, along with 44 other governors. And this agreement, per se, was a fairly detailed agreement that talks about a lot of the things we've been working on in the Opioid Committee, and it really does parallel some of the important pieces of information in the CARA legislation. They plan on getting back, I believe it's in the winter of 2017, in the next 6 to 8 months, and essentially they're supposed to be updating at the state level what their states are doing to address this. So, I think there is all the stars are aligned right now across the board. We have federal legislation. We have all the governors coming together to agree. Now we need the legislature to agree. So if there's anything that needs to happen, we need the voice to get into the legislature. We need to...
You mean the Hawaii legislature.
Hawaii legislature, yeah. Right. And then we also ultimately need to get a comprehensive package of bills passed, and the appropriations have to follow. I mean, we have to realize that if we look at appropriations now, we are going to be saving an enormous amount of money for the things that don't show up in the bottom line, all the emergency room visits, all the intensive care visits, all the law enforcement, the ambulances that are just going nonstop to pick up people. So, we need to now work on this getting through to the legislature. Some of these will need to have statutes and have to have actual laws passed. Some of these things can be done just with coordinated efforts.
Okay, let's talk about what has to happen from a statute perspective and what you see mirroring this piece of legislation that's, a federal piece of legislation. That's all. Many people would say that's good and well, that's nice, but it doesn't really show up here until, as you say, we take it into the legislature and create our own legislation which mirrors it or furthers it. Judge Alm, what has to happen in this next legislative session if this is to move within the next year.
Well, I take my hat off to Dr. Miskovich and Senator Green, because for the last couple of years, they started a statewide narcotic working group, bringing together top physicians, treatment providers, pharmacists, both with the military and civilian, in order to look at this area and come up with recommendations for the legislature. And I think the work of that group has been outstanding. Mm-hmm. Efforts have been started with the legislature, and I know there's been some success, but I think that's where legislation could really help.
Are you working on that now?
The group reconvenes in September. We'll be having at least four meetings and probably some subgroup meetings between now and the end of the year. Mm-hmm. I had some spent most of yesterday afternoon talking to leadership within Department of Health, who has to be a key partner in this. I talked to the acting administrator of the Narcotics Enforcement Division, who is also a key person in this, as well as the amazing group of leaders that volunteer their time and come together to talk about this. So, yeah, we're right in the midst of gearing up, and have no doubt that by the time we hit December, we'll be ready to have a comprehensive package that will parallel everything that's looking from the governors to the federal legislation. And I'll let Alan talk about the other key piece that needs to happen, which is from what we need is funding for more treatment options. We really are so desperate to have more treatment options more immediately accessible, because as Judge Alm said, the courts are filling up a lot of our beds out there, and yet we have a lot of the walking, functionally addicted patients that we see in our practices every day. We don't have anywhere to turn. We're just so short of services right now because they're maxed out.
And it's only until someone really crashes and burns that they can actually get some help. That's been your point for a long time, that with those who are, as you call them, you know, functionally addicted, they need help too, but there's not necessarily a place for them to go. Also, there's been criticism that when someone, you know, comes into a situation like Hinamalka or other places, that a 30-day stay is not nearly enough to be able to get someone to a place where they could begin to seriously look at their lives and be able to make some, you know, some changes. Yes, they can get clean within that time, but catching up with everything else emotionally, psychologically, takes a whole lot longer. And there are families that feel greatly frustrated that there isn't some other next step that doesn't involve someone mm-hmm. having to go find a sober house or be out there in the world. Mm-hmm. How do you begin to see that this might give you some greater leverage in being able to, A, get paid for more longer, and also to be able to help people who haven't just crashed and burned yet?
Well, I see this bill as really helping by changing the attitudes of, you know, how treatment can help solve our problems. And a lot of people know that already. We've already got, you know, we're a little bit ahead of many states. There are some states ahead of us, but we're well along. We have medication-assisted treatment, so we can get paid for medications. I think HMSA was a leader of doing that. I was on the governor's task force for 2 years, and we talked about, okay, we've got to start educating primary care doctors so that if somebody comes in with abuse but isn't quite a really severe chronic illness, okay, can we get some treatment for them at the primary care? And then if they do need treatment from us, then can they access treatment? And then also, can then primary care manage them over the next couple of years so that, you know, to make sure that they're staying in recovery and address them if they need relapse? I mean, that's a really key part. That's the major thrust of our strategic plan that Governor Ige has led out. And so we're ahead for that. What this bill says is that, hey, that's a really great idea. You need to do more. And you need to fund that, even, you know, help that with even on a state level. And we need that. You know, it's not funded. So how are we going to do that? We don't know yet. We have a great plan.
How many beds short are you? I mean, if you could help those who really come to you and say, I need some help, Alan, how many people would you need to be able to help?
The other issue is that we have 48 beds. We're building 16 more. There's only a few hundred beds in Hawaii, and we carry a 40-bed wait list. And what's happened over the last few years with the Affordable Care Act is the hospitals and everyone who said, okay, we admit that drug and alcohol and mental health people are very, very expensive, and they're some of the main reasons why our health care costs are so high. So let's identify them, and let's get them over to places like Hinamalka. Well, then they run into a couple problems. You know, the first one is we're full, and the second one is if you're really chronically ill, and we say, well, if you have a depression, you have diabetes, you have PTSD, and you have a substance abuse problem, well, we need some doctors and nurses on site to help you with that. We don't have that. And so we've said, you know, like some of the other states that are more progressive, we said we need to have that model because it's way cheaper than a hospital. And so we need to help those people because otherwise we're saying we're not going to help them. I mean, we don't have the capability to handle them. We could do their substance abuse, but that's not enough when you're in this tremendous pain and you have PTSD. So we need that support. So that's payment reform. We said, look, we need to have a new model, and then we need to have it funded right. And then the other end is that, hey, you're just running into these huge wait lists. Now, for outpatient, we can do a really good job, but we just do substance abuse in there, and we don't really handle any mental health issues or physical issues at all. And so we need to have some kind of coordinated care on that. We've been like the black sheep of everyone not wanting to pay attention to us for a lot of years, and now all of a sudden we're popular because we can save a lot of money and we can help a lot of people, but that fragmentation's still there. So that's Bill here says, let's end the fragmentation, so that's a good thing for us. But a lot of work needs to be done for us to help there, and I credit HMSA for leading the charge. I credit the governor for doing that, but we're moving really slow, and there's a lot of people that are hurting. And how do we change the systems? Because we could help a lot of people and we could save a lot of money.
I'm watching heads nod all the way around this table. Yeah. You mentioned that, you know, there are some states who are doing this really well and which are quite progressive. Which states?
Well, you know, North Carolina and Vermont, Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington, California is really catching up really fast there. I mean, all these states that were behind, Hawaii was first. You know, we were like better than everybody else.
We've heard that story a couple of times.
And everyone says, that's really good. But now everyone's passing us up because we're standing still. We're not moving. We're just still sitting here. Now we're putting together a lot of plans, and I'm part of, you know, those plans for that too. But I think we need to start moving. And that what these other states have done is they've begun in partnership with the federal government, investing money, and they're having really good returns on investments. So that's the step we need to do, step forward with. I think at the legislature now, we have to say an investment needs to be done. You can save some money. You don't save it the first year. Within 2-3 years, you do, but we need to make that a priority. So that's the message out there.
And that's clearly where you've been working.
Yeah, I'd like to just add on to what Alan says, and that is the changing face of addiction in our state. And that is, when you look at the demographics, people are getting older with addiction. And so what Alan is saying is that we don't just typically have this young, healthy person that we're trying to treat. We have people that have very complex medical illnesses. Most of them, and 50% or more, are going to have complex medical illnesses. So the old model that was funded before of just this basic, straightforward addiction can't be handled. You need medical doctors. You need to be watching their heart. You need to be watching their kidneys. They will have liver disease. They'll have hepatitis C. And that's the unseen cost of addiction that we don't put into understanding all these medical comorbidities that we're all paying for as taxpayers that need to be addressed at the same time. They keep spiraling out of the control. When you're addicted, you're not following up to see your doctor for your regular visits. You're not taking care of your blood pressure. You show up with a heart attack. You show up with a stroke. And if we had the root cause treated, you probably wouldn't have that burden on the society and the families.
If you're joining us now, we are talking about a new piece of legislation that was just passed into law. President Obama signed it last Friday. It's the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act of 2016. Not a familiar thing to you? Well, maybe you want to take a closer look. We're doing that tonight. And if you have a question or a comment or somebody in your family who is addicted, or maybe that's even you, and looking at how the changing face of addiction might just be you and how you might see some help at some point or somebody else in your family because of changes in the way we are approaching addiction. 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I realize a lot of people have been tuning into the Democratic Convention and listening to Hillary Clinton's speech. But as you've finished off with that and thinking about real life right here, what this means for you and your family, this is a piece of legislation that might figure prominently, as especially it's becoming a model for what we may see turn up, very well likely turn up, in the next legislative session. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. We touched on this just a little bit early, but it's worth going back and taking a look at again. the way the rest of the world regards those who are addicted. We talked about just a moment ago, Scott Miskovich was talking about the fact that, you know, addiction isn't just a kid who comes in and presents and needs some help so that he can get or she can get off drugs. You have so many, you know, codependent situations and people who are truly, you know, living through this together and not necessarily changing their lifestyle, not necessarily wanting to get off drugs or think that they can be functional in all of this. I mean, everybody has a story about someone who, you know, is drinking a whole lot or drugging a whole lot, but, you know, they show up every morning and they do their job and all that. This is not just the person who's going to jail or a kid, which is to say that we have to get a different idea of what happens with drugs in our society.
And I think that's getting better. The more we talk about it, I think Governor Lingle did a good job talking about mental health issues, getting them out here. Everybody in the state has people in their family or friends who are having problems with drugs and alcohol. So I think one of the exciting things about this, we're all disappointed there wasn't funding attached. But at the same time, the atmosphere in Washington is really tough. And I think when it comes to opiate addiction, when it comes to law enforcement, that's one of the few areas that the Democrats and Republicans, I think, can try to get something done together. And so that was the fact that this was passed. I think this is, you know, an authorization bill. Next will be appropriations. And I think once the, you know, presidential election, you know, fever is gone, maybe that will be a time where they can come and fund this. One of the things we've tried to do in the criminal justice system is to be smart on crime and try to identify, are there ways we can triage out people that can stop on their own? So one of the fascinating things we discovered about Hope Probation is half the people or more can stop using on their own without going to treatment. If they know there's going to be a jail sanction, even if it's short, for any drug use, many people stop on their own. The advantage of that is it saves the precious treatment spots we do have for the people that really need it.
And the money that goes into all of that.
Absolutely. And what we need then, though, is we need a dedicated funding stream. We don't want to throw money out there for fly-by-night people who don't know what they're doing to start doing drug treatment, put up a sign. We need to encourage the good drug treatment programs we have, like Hinamauka, like ATS, like Women's Way, like Ho'omau Keola, Sand Island. You know, there are a bunch of good programs out there. We want to, but there's got to be a dedicated funding stream so they can plan ahead and they can hire more people. And be able to know this is happening and that they're going to be able to have a continued source of funding. Because right now we have people sitting in jail who need drug treatment, and there are waiting lists. And that's a very expensive place for people to wait.
Well, when you're talking about, you know, a waiting list, but not just a waiting list, you're talking 40 people deep. That's a long period of time that you may wait until you come up to the top.
Yep. And if somebody is motivated to go into treatment, that's the time you want them to get started in treatment.
All right. Well,
we lose so many of them because they're on the wait list and they can't get in. And so our list is constantly changing, always staying full, but it's different faces all the time because the vast majority just aren't going to wait a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks.
To say nothing of maybe having to wait a month or more.
Months.
Or months, more likely. Yeah. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 is our number. It'll only take you minutes to get through, not months, and we can talk more about this and what it means for you and your family. Going now to Trudy calling us from Kona. Aloha, Trudy. Thank you for your patience.
Hi.
Hi there.
Trudy. I just wanted to talk to you about my addiction. And let me tell you, it's not easy, you know, when you get into it. I went to the hospital for a four-day depression. It cost me $10,000. And, excuse me, I didn't have a home address, so the person that I was using as a home address, excuse me, got dementia. So then I got taken off the list, you know. So, and I don't know, I just think that you guys have cleaned up a lot. Maybe you could pick my brain. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what to say right now. I'm hurting, though.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you're calling. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad that you're calling and you're asking for help, and I think that staying in touch with the treatment agency really helps because I think you don't for a treatment agency, you don't need to have a permanent address. So there are a lot of folks who don't have an address that come to us. So it's just a matter of staying in contact by phone and continuing on them. I know you're on the Big Island, so there are several programs out there like BISEC, so that's a good way to stay in touch on there. And that's a good part of what you mentioned on the system, is that you can end up in the hospital because you're having a major depression, and then, okay, now you're being released, and so many people are self-medicating on their depression with substance abuse, and now they need the help to get off the substance abuse. And so they know go hand in hand, and that's what this bill is trying to do, is say, hey, look, you guys need to coordinate better. And, you know, let go of your old attitudes. Get into the new attitudes of, hey, it's a medical condition. There's medical treatments we can work. And so, but for you, I encourage you to please call BISEC, because you're on the Big Island. And certainly, if you're having troubles, I don't have their number right on hand, but 236-2600 is Hinomauka. You call us. We'll call BISEC for you. We'll help you.
Thanks very much for the call, Trudy. You know, she brings up an issue, though, that we see happening on the streets all the time, where you have people who are addicted to one or more substances, people who have mental illnesses, which may be feeding into that, too. And they are very unreliable in being able to, as you say a little earlier, you know, make sure that they go in and have the appropriate follow-up or even get there in the first place. But there's also this idea, well, if I don't have an address, I mean, you heard what she had to say, or if I can't get here or I can't do that, well, then I might as well not do it. And that keeps people just in their own isolation. How much outreach are we doing with people who need to have that kind of help? Are we doing enough?
Beth Ann, I think, you know, this will dovetail over to probably a couple more shows that you'll have to do, but I think that there's a big wait list that everybody in the Oahu really understands, and it's called our homeless population. And, you know, city and county's own statistics have determined that 70% of all the unsheltered homeless are suffering from some form of addiction. Another 50% are suffering from some form of mental illness. And many of these are in that category that you're describing, which is what we call dual diagnosis. And so when you talk about a wait list, that's a wait list that really is right there, where we see the suffering every day. We see people that we know fit those categories, and we need to find a way to reach out to them. But, you know, if we started to talk about, you know, the everybody agrees that across the country, Housing First has been successful, but Housing First only works when there's immediate wraparound services that apply these people once they're in stable housing to case management, and then get them to Allen, get them into appropriate mental health treatment so that they can then get the care to then stay off the streets. And so that's a big concern I have, is that we are so short right now just with the number of beds that we have. We haven't even tapped into our largest population that needs treatment, that we are trying to put this heroic effort, and it's been a great effort by the state and by the city and county. But the back end to stop this is not there.
Do you think people really understand that as well as perhaps, you know, they should? We talk about homelessness so much. We have people calling in and complaining about what they see in their neighborhoods, certainly looking at the last 3 years. But with, you know, once you stop pointing the finger and start looking at some of the reasons, the back end reasons for it, certainly outreach providers have been saying this for a long time. Every time we talk to them, that there are not enough of us, there are not enough services, there are not enough beds. We can only do so much. And yet, when you see people cycling in and cycling out, you know, the success stories are fabulous, and that's a wonderful thing. But the question is, how do you keep people from falling into the situation in the first place, if you can't, or stopping them before they fall? Can you raise, you know, the bottom for any of this?
Yeah, Beth Ann, I think you're tapping onto one of the most important things we need to look at. You know, my view is for these people that homelessness is basically a large portion of the unsheltered homeless is a failed medical process that we have not been able to address, that now becomes a social issue. We have this constant conveyor belt of people who are now the future homelessness. They're in all of our doctor's offices, they're in our families, they're everywhere. And we're not doing enough to address the root cause, because these people will eventually be the people that get off their psychiatric meds. These eventually will be the functional meth addict that becomes the meth addict that loses their job, or the meth addict that breaks up with the family and ends up in the street. So unless we start getting these treatments available right now, we're never going to solve our homelessness problem.
And, well, I could add to that is that those who are very functional as a homeless, the Housing First is working really well.
Right.
Now, those who are not functional, it's not working as well, and it's had, because the wraparound services aren't really there. But it isn't because there are no wraparound services. It's that, you know, we haven't had the payment reform yet to increase. I mean, those homeless are have really major comorbidity issues. And you come onto our wait list of 40 people, and you're going to say, I'm going to take this one who needs doctors and nurses, and we don't have them, and this one who doesn't. Well, they're not getting through our wait list. And so it's a major block. And so people get tired. We're not going to send them to you.
All right, we've got lots of callers on the line. If you'd like to join us, now is the time to call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We'll get you all through as we can. Going to Terrence, calling us from Kaimuki. Aloha, Terrence. Welcome
to
Town
Square. Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty well, thank you. How are you?
All right. I just wanted to say, you know, I actually was a heroin addict for 2 years here in Hawaii, and I kicked it, but my brother couldn't. And just looking for opiate addiction, you know, help and therapy to get off in Hawaii, it's ridiculous. Hard, and you know, it's kind of behind. He had to go to the mainland, California, to do it because that was the only 30-day program. You know, it just feels like, you know, you go to the emergency room and you ask for help, and they tell you they can't do anything for you. You know, so 90% of the people go straight back to the dealer.
And that's sort of that same revolving door that we talked about mm-hmm. a moment ago. Well, Terrence, I'm glad you're doing well. How's your brother doing?
He's doing well now. I've been clean for a year now. Kicked it myself because I couldn't get help. But I'm glad to hear that, you know, that's changing because, you know, people really need help here.
Well, I'm glad that you seem to be one of those extraordinary individuals who did it on his own. And we'll hold good thoughts for you and your brother. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. Aloha.
Yeah, good to hear.
Kalo now is on the line from the Big Island. You could be next, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act and what that could mean for Hawaii as legislation is being prepared that will mirror it and will be introduced next legislative session. Aloha, Kalo.
Aloha, y'all. I just wanted to say thank you for making this discussion available. I fought with mental health as well as substance abuse issues, as I did self-medicate a lot and went on pain management. And if the providers and the insurance companies were just a little cooperative in making it easy enough to come off of like pain medication as it was to receive the pain medication, then that would be so much more helpful than it is now, because it took me 2 years and being rejected 4 times from Hina Manco. First of all, because I'm diabetic, and secondly, because I was on a heroin replacement medication called Subutex. And after 2 years, I finally got into the outpatient program, and then they had some kind of internal problems with the counselors and stuff that led to an untimely discharge without very many options. So it's really difficult. I'm self-motivated and not facing any legal issues, but the availability of the resources and also the lack of updated information, updated attitudes like you guys were talking about, sometimes makes it a little bit more difficult. But I'm finding success now working with quite a few mm-hmm. different agencies.
Well, I'm glad that is all happening for you and that you have had the tenacity to stick with all of this. But, you know, the idea of you know, it's really easy to be given pain meds for very legitimate reasons. And then many people, as we know, we've talked about that one for a long time, too, become addicted to it. And as he says, if it were only as easy to get off them as it is when it's given to you. How do we figure that into this equation, too? Because although we've talked about how many people are addicted to prescription pain medications, somehow, you know, when people hear that story, anecdotally, you know, the feeling toward it is a little different than what happens if, you know, somebody is using illegal drugs. And yet we know how many of these prescription drugs wind up as being illegal drugs. So that goes back to the attitude that Kayla was talking about. And certainly, as we touched on earlier, in how we view addiction, period, regardless of how somebody got there.
Beth Ann, I think this is going to be covered at multiple levels. First of all, if you look at the federal legislation, there is a tremendous amount that talks about education. It's education at every level. It's education that occurs on the patient level. It takes it into an act that takes it into the schools. It talks about pregnant women. It talks about education in the prisons, in the VAs, on the mainland in Indian tribes. But it also talks about physician education. We need to educate our physicians. And the environment in treating pain has been changing, and we need to provide comprehensive education to the physicians. So that's part of what our committee will be doing here locally. We're going to be talking about providing continuing education to the physicians. And there's another aspect that would also tie into this that is going to be one of the top things we're going to have on our list of recommendations to the legislature, and that's an informed consent. That's where when you are going to be started on a medication and you're a physician, you really have an obligation, both the physician and the patient, to sit down eye to eye and talk about what are the expectations, what are the risks, what are the benefits. That conversation should be ongoing with the patient.
That also says that you have enough time to have that conversation with your patient and not running people through to where their eyes glaze over and they don't have a hot clue what you actually just said when they leave. That's a whole other subject, which we'll have to talk about another time because we've got lots of callers on the line who want to talk to all of you. Aya is calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Aya, and thank you for your patience.
Hi. Thank you for letting me speak. I happen to be a case manager for the mentally ill in Honolulu. So many of my clients are addicts and are homeless. And like the last caller just mentioned about being discharged and maybe not even having housing available, and then that leads back to the cycle of possible addiction. And then also with the facilities here that deny so many of my clients because they have to take medications that are in conflict with the facility's rules. So that has been a huge, huge problem. I mean, most of them deny clients based on something like that. And then when clients actually get into housing, because housing to me is the first step, as you guys discussed, they usually actually can get clean. Many of my clients have gotten clean on their own. It's just up to the community, I think, to be patient with their adjustment to housing, you know, because they end up running into a lot of problems with even just like neighbors, law enforcement, where they may end up arrested and then they lose their benefits, they lose their housing, they're back in the system, they get back on the street and they get addicted to drugs again. So it's kind of a, when we just talked about education, which was great, part of that education should be patience, understanding, and having like an open dialogue that's grounded in curiosity and, you know, understanding why this is happening and how to remedy it as a community.
Spoken like a public radio listener. Thank you so very much, Aya, for calling in. Alan, but she brings up the point that if you have medication that you have to take, that sometimes that becomes the barrier if you're in a situation where, you know, you're in residential.
That's true, and especially if some of that medication is narcotic, you really run into that. Treatment agencies like Hinomoka have certainly progressed along that way, and now we even give out medications. But there's still some medications we're really concerned about, and especially some of them have severe side effects, which we're not able to handle. And then if you have a significant mental health issue, but you're not so severe that you're in the adult mental health system or Hawaii State Hospital, then that's a problem finding housing. So I would really hope for that we can develop a housing second, that now that you've been through treatment, now you can access housing first. So you're stable and you can go into that. So there should be that, too, because if, you know, if you're clean and sober and you have a substance abuse problem, you can find a clean and sober home. If you're mental health, oh, it's going to be hard.
All right. Well, we're going to move on and see how many more of our callers we can get through to all of you. Going to Victoria, calling us from Kapolei. And if you'd like to be next, again, our number is 941-3689, 941-3689 from Oahu, or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the neighbor islands. Aloha, Victoria.
Hi, I was calling. I left the topic.
Victoria, I got to tell you, we can barely hear you.
Can you hear me better?
Not terribly well. Make sure you're speaking right into the mouthpiece of your phone.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Not so well. I'm going to ask you to call us right back. We're going to move on, and we'll try to take you in just a moment. Going now to John from Mililani. Aloha, John. Welcome to Town Square. John, you there? John? John, you there? Okay, I'm hearing some funkiness on the phone, and I don't know why that's happening, but we'll give you another shout out in just a second. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you have a question about what it would mean to have programs change under the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act.
One of the things I found fascinating as part of the working group was just hearing the doctors talk about how they have been educated and that when they went to medical school 20 or 30 years ago, I think some of the synthetic opiates were seen as kind of a magic bullet. They weren't going to be addictive, you know, feel free to give them out. And as the other caller talked about, it's a lot easier to give the medication than to help somebody get off the medication.
Well, once upon a time, you know, heroin was being made by the Bayer Company, and that was being given as, you know, heralded as the yep. wonder drug. Yeah.
One something I think that has to be said that we as a country have to come to grips with is that for many of the minority communities, particularly African-American communities, people have been dying of heroin overdoses for decades. And now that it really is all over the place, it's in white America, it's getting the attention of the politicians. So better late than never. But it did take something like that to get Washington, official Washington, D.C., to really pay attention to that. And at least hopefully now we can try to help everybody who's in this kind of situation.
We've got some folks who've been paying attention to us and seeing if their lines are going to be working again. We're going to go back to Victoria. Victoria, you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, that's much better than last time. Not great, so make sure you speak right into your mouthpiece. Thanks.
Okay. So I was calling because I really love this topic. I'm married to a heroin and meth addict, and he was doing really great in recovery. He had found a psychiatrist that would be prescribed him with Suboxone, and so his opioid use completely stopped once he was able to use the Suboxone. Unfortunately, he's had really bad problems with staying sober as far as the meth goes, and so it's been difficult for him to find a doctor that will still prescribe him the Suboxone because there's only a few doctors, I think, on island that do. And so I was just curious, you know, what is the process for doctors to be able to prescribe Suboxone? Because it seems to be very limited. It seems like they
okay.
have to be a very specific.
Let me get you an answer, Victoria, because Dr. Miskovich has one for you.
Okay.
Suboxone, you have to be certified at a federal level, and there is legislation now that's trying to move to broaden the number. When you get certified at a federal level, there's only a limited number of patients you're allowed to have under your Suboxone treatment for the first year.
30,
which is small, right, and 30. And so there is legislation, there is education going on to try to expand the number of patients a doctor can have in the Suboxone treatment. There also is a big push to expand the number of doctors who will be trained and educated in the appropriate use of Suboxone. So this is included in what we're talking about right now.
Also, you can just I don't mean to be broadcasting our phone number, but it's 236-2600 Hinomoka. We have psychiatrists on staff who can do that. And we also have a list of psychiatrists who can give you Suboxone. So we could direct you to somebody who can help you with that.
All right. Thanks very much, Victoria, for the call. And we hope all things go well with you. Going now to John calling us from Mililani and hoping that line is much better than it was a moment ago. John, you there?
Hi, I'm so sorry about that. Can you guys hear me okay?
No, that's fine. I don't think it was your fault. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you for taking my call. I was on the HOPE program for a couple of years. I got arrested for two terroristic threatenings and a switchblade that I had on me that I didn't know was illegal at the time. And I did the HOPE program where I had my color. I called in, you know, every day, showed up for my drug test. I did have to go back for a weekend in jail because I did pee positive once, and I got a DUI in those 10 years. It was a 5-year plea, and then it eventually went to a 10-year one because of the DUI. It happened 3 years after. I just recently got done with my sentence. I know this is kind of far off of what you guys are talking about, but I've been
so bring it back.
Basically, what I'm saying is, now that I'm done with my probation, is there anything I can do to get this withdrawal, have this stricken from my record forever, or is that too late?
You know, it all you'd have to go back and talk to your attorney. It depends on what the. If you were on a deferral, it's possible that that's wiped off the record now. If it's on probation, it depends if it was one of the types of probation that the legislature would allow to be wiped off your record afterwards. If not, and it's on regular probation, then probably not. But you'd have to go talk to an attorney. The only other way would be to apply to the governor for a pardon. You know, and that's going to take a number of years of sobriety, a number of years of staying out of trouble, so a governor's willing to take a chance on wiping it off your record. But the first thing you should do is call your attorney, if it was a public defender, and ask them to look at your case and give you the right advice.
We're coming up to the top of the hour, and we're going to have to say goodbye shortly. But when you look at the treatment and recovery programs for the United States, of which, you know, you are part and a very big part in Hawaii. One of the criticisms is that there tends to be so much reliance on a 12-step program, and that for some people, that's just not going to be something that's going to work well. Does it matter whether there is a 12-step program or another type of program? If you're talking about best practices, is there something that we need a different lens that we need to look through when we look at what makes a good program for someone that would be able to access it under the standards and the evidence-based material that Kara says we need to have to be able to make this a program that would be promulgated?
Well, Kara does say they want to expand the recovery. You know, having a 12-step is a really great program, and it really helps a lot of people. But not everyone finds that that's useful for them. But there are some churches out there that are now, you know, doing that kind of work. And there are also some groups who say, we're kind of like the 12-step, but we don't really have the more religious aspects of that to it. And so that they're more, you know, clear on that and kind of redesign some of their support systems. Having a support system, though, makes a huge difference. So
regardless of what it is.
So you really need that support system out there. I mean, it's a chronic illness, which means it keeps showing up. It takes several years to work through this, the really hard part of it. And so you're not going to be in treatment for several years. You're going to need that support system. So having some peers that can help you work through that really makes a difference. But for those who really object to 12-step, there are other options out there for them.
I am so glad that we do have the treatment programs we do, because as I've traveled around the country, I've discovered a number of states don't have any drug treatment at all.
That's hard to believe.
It is hard in this day and age. In places like New Hampshire, there are no treatment programs. Right next door in Massachusetts, there are all sorts of treatment.
Or Vermont.
And even then, it's limited. But in a place like New Hampshire, you might have some expensive programs for regular probation. And otherwise, we discovered there is no treatment for people to send it to. Maybe they've been helped by the fact that the first presidential primary was there, and that became an issue that everybody was talking about. But that came as a surprise. So I'm so happy. I wish we had more and more beds, but I'm so happy for the treatment programs we do have.
Well, Hawaii has done a really good job, and HMSA has been a leader on that, and we are ahead. And we were first, and now maybe we're 10th, but we could get back up to that.
Really quickly, I'm going to go right around the table. One thing that you want to have people take away as you look at this piece of legislation, you each have about 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Let's encourage our legislators to fund the efforts that we need to be done.
Dr. Miskovich.
100% agree, and it's going to be education at every different level.
This is going to change stigma, and it's going to get us to work together. It's a good start. Let's not stop here. Let's do more.
Alan Johnson coming from Hinamaka. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Scott Miskovich, and to Judge Ulm. Thank you for being here. And thank you for joining us tonight for Town
thank
Square.
Thanks,
we'll be
Bethany.
Following this piece of legislation and seeing what happens as we hit next year and see if it's going to get funded. In the meantime, I will see you tomorrow morning right back here for The Conversation. Have yourselves a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.